This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. On this program, we aim to keep you up to date with the most significant developments happening around the world. We have a lot to talk about today. Our Trumpet writing staff is on hand to help you understand your world. Via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello. One of the stories I'll be talking about is a creative solution that the European Union is looking at to try and solve at least part of the refugee crisis.
Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Yes, today we'll be talking about the Roman Catholic Church's opinion on Britain's place in the European Union and what that means for the future of Europe.
We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi, I'll be talking about Russia cozying up to the Armenians and the Kurds and how this is playing into a strategy of Russia apparently circling Turkey.
And we have Robert Morley.
Good to be here. Today I'd like to talk a little bit about a sign that indicates we could be nearing another Lehman Brothers moment in the markets.
Let's start by talking about politics. With the world becoming more dangerous, the number of threats rising, this is having some very strange effects on the political scene. We're going to talk about the effects on American politics, but I want to go first to Europe. There we have serious economic problems. We have a massive refugee crisis. We have a lot of fear about the activities of Russia. Europeans feel a serious need for security and for solutions, and this is driving them to support some politicians and some ideas that really they wouldn't otherwise be supporting. Andrew is going to give us a look at some of the ramifications of this trend in Europe.
Yes. Well, as we've spoken on so many times on this program, the refugee crisis, this is really transforming the entire political landscape of Europe. One of the biggest developments in that this week is actually a German politician we've kept an eye on sometime before, Edmund Stoiber, had come out with some very strong comments really against Merkel's refugee policy and the dangers this is posing to the European Union. He'd said, the current situation in Europe means strengthening of right-wing parties within the EU. It would be narrow-minded to look only at the alternative for Deutschland. We must also look at Le Pen, Wilders, or the Freedom Party of Austria. These are other so-called far-right parties in Europe that are just surging in the polls due to this anti-immigration sentiment. And he's really bringing out that he said we need to transform politics at the European level to get these parties to calm down.
Mm-hmm. So an overall trend, we've talked about the far right, but you're drawing attention to, and we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly about just how some of the ideas that are being put forward by the far right actually aren't so right.
Right. That is, it is amazing that I'm actually not a big fan of the terms far right and far left. You kind of have to use them just because they're all over the place in the political discourse today. But those terms are dating back a couple hundred years to the French Revolution, when the far right referred to this very pro-Catholic, pro-monarchist movement that supported the king, and the far left supported this very secular, very socialist movement that supported forcing everyone to be equal, whether their actions merited that or not. So today in Europe, a lot of these parties, they call far right because they do hearken back to that very nationalist, pro-monarchist movement they had in history. But a lot of the, they're also espousing very strong social welfare states, even using some iconography that harkens back to the communist era, showing that they're really, at least on the economic side, very radically left as well, or what you consider very radically left.
Right. So in Europe, it doesn't seem like anyone is really proposing the kind of free market type reforms on the scale of what we've seen historically in America. The socialist ideals tend to be pretty strong over there. And they've found their way into the far-right position or of those parties. They're espousing those kinds of economic models. But there's also the, say, the platform, the parts of their platform that are more traditionally far right, what would those include?
Those would definitely include just this very kind of like a nationalist sentiment to require like national greatness, national pride, just this really overblown patriotism that really manifests itself with a lot of these far right parties that are saying that we need to make our people great and get these immigrants out of here.
And that's really exacerbated by the immigration crisis.
That is very exacerbated by the immigration crisis. But I think one of the main points I wanted to draw out here from this this Anne Applebaum article we have in our Trumpet Weekly titled Europe's New Right Sounds a Lot Like the Old Left. But there's also this this popular wisdom, I guess, at least in the mainstream media, that the European Unity Project's going to fall apart because you've got all these far-right parties in the north of Europe and then all these communist and socialist and far-left parties in Greece and Portugal and Spain, and they're just going to rip this in half because they're so different. And what this Financial Times article in Trumpet Weekly points out, and they said, well, on the economic standpoint, they're actually not all that different. This is a populist protest against austerity and wanting more government intervention for job creations and the economy. And even some of these far-left parties, they're not as anti-immigrant as what you call this far-right one, but they're not necessarily cheerleaders for the immigrants either, to where they're saying that there's really not as much difference between these far-left parties in Greece and these far-right parties in Poland as you'd think. And if, like Edmund Stoiber says, you have a change at the European level to really crack down on immigration and get some more jobs creation, a lot of both these far-left parties and far-right parties could be your biggest supporters for a reform like that.
Well, that is interesting to consider how it could be that, say, a leader could seize hold of some of these issues that really do have a lot of traction among a lot of Europeans and get a lot of support from quite a different, a varied coalition of Europeans. In one sense, you look at this and you can understand, say, this far-right position, even though it's economically more socialistic and more nationalistic in other ways, you really have to see the common denominator as being strong government. You know, who do you turn to in a crisis? You turn to the government. You defend our nation and you give us all the economic benefits that we want.
That absolutely. That's a great way of putting it, because that really is the main call of these far right parties, is that we need government intervention to deport immigrants. And it's the main call of these far left parties, is that we need government immigration to create jobs and give welfare handouts and other things. So they're both of them. The solution is more government. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are protesting against the European Union because they would figure, it's like, well, if Brussels won't do it, we'll turn to our national capitals to do it. Though a lot of that national sentiment is often misrepresented in the mainstream media. If Brussels or Berlin or some other central European capital would make those government reforms they're calling for, someone like Marie Le Pen, the glory of France, is going right out the window. They're gonna support Brussels or Berlin or whoever's gonna give them the job reforms and the immigrant reforms they want.
It is really fascinating to watch the climate in Europe develop toward what we've been saying for so long, that it really is going to be some kind of a strongman who stands up and unifies the continent. And as crises increase, as the threats to Europe increase, the call for that and the climate that would create conditions for him to rise up really are proceeding exactly as you would expect them to, according to the Bible prophecies.
Right. That is quite an amazing thing with looking at the Bible prophecy, is that is the two of the main prophecies we've talked about this rising Holy Roman Empire, is that they're going to wage a blitzkrieg war against radical Islam, and they're going to institute some sort of economic policy that guarantees employment to those who go to Mass on Sunday. So these are two major government problems on both the economic level and the foreign policy level that these populist far left and far right parties in Europe, and that's exactly what they want right now.
Very interesting to watch. Thanks for bringing that to our attention. I'd like to turn now to America. And in some ways, what's happening in America politically, I think you could view as a similar trend. This last week, we had Super Tuesday, and the most popular Republican candidate is showing a similar combination of ideals to what we were talking about in Europe. But this man, Donald Trump, he's really turning the whole presidential race completely on its head. Clearly, there's a lot of frustration and anger among Americans at the direction of the country. It's not hard to understand why. But the question is, where is this anger leading? It's creating an enormous amount of support for Mr. Trump, and he's getting bolder and bolder in stirring up that anger and using it to help his campaign. But it's also creating a lot of anger. The more success he has, the more anger he generates. So we have an interesting article in the Trumpet Weekly from The Atlantic this week talking about this. And to bring this to us, we'll turn to Robert Morley.
Yeah, The Atlantic does have an interesting article this week just asking the question, what will happen in the United States if Donald Trump becomes a Republican nominee? And this article goes on to say that America, if that happens, America is set to become a whole lot more violent. And it says there's a lot of, it's making the case that there's a lot of parallels today as back to the 1960s and the civil rights movement. And they're saying that the conditions we have today, America has not seen since that time. And it goes on to point out that many of the people within the Black Lives Matter movement, they were given a lot to hope for in the Obama presidency. They were very excited. There was unprecedented excitement among young progressives. But the article goes on to say that they have had extremely deep disillusionment with President Obama. And he has not been radical enough for them. He has not accomplished enough for them. And now they are starting to take their protests to the street. And it goes through and talks about how this movement started back with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. And then it just kind of built from there. Rallies to stop deportation of illegals. You know, the death of Michael Brown, the thug, the shooting, the riots in Baltimore. And just how this movement is gaining strength. And how it's even gotten traction in the Democrat Party. The author goes to point out that Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, all of them, to one degree or another, have sat down and met with the Black Lives Movement, and after those meetings have come out and embraced much of what they're calling for. And that's exactly the opposite of what has happened in the Republican Party. The author says that Republicans, for the most part, have tried to ignore the Black Lives Movement, except for Donald Trump. And Donald Trump really has been outspoken against this movement. Just, you know, earlier this year, after Bernie Sanders met with the Black Lives Matter movement, and actually I think one of their protesters came up on stage at one of these events, and Bernie Sanders, you know, turned the stage over to him, let him talk. And Trump said that was totally, he called it totally disgusting. He said that would never, ever happen. If I'm president, that will never happen with me. And he went through, Trump has pointed out time after time after time where these Black Lives Movement protesters have stepped over the line. And he's not afraid to do it. He is not politically correct in any way. And this really is stirring up, I think, a lot of people on the left hand, on the left side of politics in America.
Yeah, this Atlantic article gives some examples of just how he really seems to be, you said he's the one candidate who's actually standing up to the Black Lives Matter protesters. And it's almost like he's using it as a rallying cry for his supporters, the fact that he is willing to stand up. This brings out the fact that last November there was a rally in Atlanta where an African-American started to chant Black Lives Matter at a Trump rally. And some reports, various reports, said that people actually started punching and kicking this man. And later on on Fox News, Trump said, well, maybe he should have been roughed up because it was absolutely disgusting what he was doing. So, he's kind of tapping into that anger. And here you've got Trump supporters who are actually undertaking violence of their own.
Yeah, it is a very polarized situation in America right now on both sides of the spectrum. I think that, Donald Trump has talked about, the good old days. And I think the author of that article is saying maybe that's a reference to the 1960s. And I don't know.
Right. This was at a rally in Nevada just last month where he said, you know what I hate? There's a guy totally disruptive throwing punches. We're not allowed to punch back anymore. I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher. He's got this sort of mobster kind of persona that a lot of his supporters really like.
Well, he's tapping into something there. I think a lot of people in America are sick and tired of being told by the government what they can't say, what they can't say, what they shouldn't be thinking, what words and verbs and tenses and ways to refer to people. I think there is a deep growing sense of anger in the United States. And I think he's doing a masterful job of tapping into that and speaking to the issues that really are important and are really bothering people in a wide range of people, especially on the right of America. But we're saying the same thing on the other side too. We're seeing the same with the Black Lives Matter movement. We have this movement that over the past 8 years has been legitimized, a movement that frankly is quite disgusting. It's built on a lie that the police are targeting Black people to kill them, which is totally wrong, which is a total lie. It's being validated by the highest level of office in our land. We have a president who's told Black people that racism is in America's DNA, that society as a whole, it's institutionally racist, and Black people cannot get ahead because of racism. So we have this whole movement that is growing in momentum. It believes these things. And now suddenly we have a potential presidential candidate who is confronting that and telling them, no, that's a lie. And if I'm president, I'm not going to put up with that kind of talk anymore. So I think there is really, we do have this potential here for really something to be explosive. To
I think the Atlantic author, he's clearly anti-Trump, but he's showing the potential for this to really explode in a way that it really hasn't to this point, because there is this growing anger. And boy, considering as much as we have talked about the potential for race riots in the United States, we've been watching this building for quite some time, but it does seem to be coming closer and closer to a head. We thank you for that, Robert. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to go in a different direction now, look at a very interesting situation developing with Russia. Last year, relations between Turkey and Russia hit a new low in November when Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet. Vladimir Putin vowed that Turkey would regret that move. Well, we're starting to see what he meant by that. We're going to start by talking about Russian activities in a former Soviet satellite that borders Turkey, that is Armenia. For this story, we'll go to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, over the last few weeks or so, Russia has been busy really beefing up its military footprint in the somewhat seldom discussed small nation of Armenia. Armenia is there in the South Caucasus, as you mentioned, just wedged right in between Turkey, Georgia, Iran, and Azerbaijan. And since it used to be a part of the Soviet Union, it's a country that Russia has worked hard to maintain close ties with. And it's in a position right there next to Turkey that makes it an increasingly high priority for Vladimir Putin's Russia. Back in December, Moscow sort of quietly signed an air defense agreement with Armenia. And now this week, Russia has deployed at least 4 new MiG-29 fighter jets, and also a slew of other military vehicles and armaments. And all of this equipment has gone to a Russian base located just outside the Armenian capital of Yerevan. So this story alone might not seem terribly significant. After all, Russia has had its base there in Armenia for many, many years. But when you zoom out a little bit and put this in the context of some other recent Russian maneuvers, it begins to paint a pretty clear picture of something worrisome for Turkey specifically, and by proxy for Europe. So I'll circle back to that big picture in just a moment. But first, I wanted to mention another related story that we've included in the Trumpet Weekly. This story is called Vladimir Putin, Godfather of Kurdistan? With a question mark. And it's a really fascinating piece, originally published in the National Interest. And it shows that the relationship between Putin's Russia and the Kurds in Syria is rapidly growing into something pretty much approaching a full-blown alliance. Now, for Turkey, that is almost the worst possible news. The Turkish government has few enemies that it hates as much as the Kurds. For decades, the Turkish Republic has been trying to stamp out a Kurdish group called the Kurdistan Workers' Party. This is a group of Kurds that have long been waging an insurgency in Turkey's southeast.
And right, that's the PKK, which the United States, at one time, they actually said that they were a terrorist organization.
Yeah, that's right. We long labeled them terrorists, and now, especially since the PKK has been instrumental in pushing ISIS back, the Islamic State back, the U.S. has totally reversed that. We no longer call them terrorists, at least officially, and now we're working with them. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a subsidiary of the PKK. It's called the PYK, a group of Kurds that Russia is now giving really robust support to. The PYK just opened a diplomatic office in Moscow, and Russia is giving them arms, really significant arms, and also air support. And thanks to all of this Russian support, the Kurds are rapidly expanding the amount of territory that they control along the Syrian-Turkish border.
So you called the PYK a subsidiary of the PKK. They have a different acronym, but essentially for Russia to support the PYK is strengthening the Kurd position and the PKK.
That's right. Yes, from Turkey's vantage point, from what I could tell, it's equally horrible.
No real difference.
For Russia to be supporting either one of these. So really, when you look at what Russia's doing there in Armenia, suddenly beefing up its military footprint, importing, deploying all kinds of new top-of-the-line, very sophisticated fighter jets and other armaments, and now it's boosting its long-standing support of these Kurdish groups to new heights, new levels. When you look at that, and then you place it in the context of what's happening there in Syria with Russia's support of the Alawites under President Assad, and what's happening in Georgia, where Russia has basically carved out two large, powerful states that are essentially de facto Russian states, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, then a clear picture emerges. And this picture shows that Russia is essentially surrounding Turkey. They've got enclaves in all of these states that that have Turkey basically surrounded. And so you just have to think that since Turkey is a NATO member, and since the Psalm 83 alliance that we sometimes talk about lumps Turkey in with Europe along those lines, I believe that Europe sees this. They see Russia surrounding one of the NATO ally nations, and this has to be something that's really concerning for the Europeans.
Right, one of the, if not the strongest army within NATO, apart from the United States.
That's right. Yeah, Turkey is just an incredibly powerful military nation. Up against Russia, though, I'm not quite sure how they'd fare, and it does look like the Russians may have some sort of a strategy to be just really surrounding the Turks in this way.
This I just want to read one quote from this National Interest article. It says, about Russia, by working with the Kurds, Moscow can prosecute the war against the Islamic State, punish Turkey, outmaneuver the United States in Syria, and provoke a rift in Turkish-U.S. relations, thereby weakening NATO. It says, another really amazing strategic move on Putin's part to accomplish all of these with one stroke, basically.
It is really astounding, and maybe it's just maneuvering to try to weaken the U.S.'s position and things like that. But there's a lot that could go wrong with so many actors at play here. I'd like to read one quote from Justin Burke. He's the managing editor at Eurasia Net. He just said, "Now the Russia-Turkey tensions, With those, there's a whole lot of people playing with matches in the region, and sometimes fires begin accidentally.
Mm-hmm. Brent, did you have a comment?
I think just how big the Kurdish issue is for Turkey. I mean, the Kurds, they make up a huge part of the population in Turkey. There's about 15 million Kurds inside Turkey, about 26 million Kurds all up. That's greater than the population of Australia. So this is a huge group of people that we kind of hear about a little bit in the news, but then we don't really bother to try and understand them. But the way that Russia, as Jeremiah is bringing out, is using the Kurds in a number of different ways to accomplish its purpose inside the Middle East is amazing. I don't think that while they're trying to grab leverage on Turkey, I don't think they're circling them. And I'm not saying Jeremiah implied this, but I don't think that they want a conflict with Turkey right now. Turkey's got 80 million people, like you say, massive army, NATO supported at least by the US. But it is interesting that they are trying to at least ensure that the Turks don't do too much against Russia's interest. I mean, Turkey has wanted at least Bashar al-Assad's rule to weaken. It's been supporting, even there's been some rumblings that's been supporting ISIS, at least allowing ISIS to travel through its border to fight Assad. And that's who, you know, Russia is supporting in there. And Russia is letting Turkey know through this that it can mobilize the Kurds if it wants. If it, as Jeremiah was saying, if they support the Syrian Kurds, that will enlarge or increase the push for statehood that the Syrian Kurds would have, which would then impact the PKK as well. And that's who Turkey cares about the most, is the Kurds. They care more about the Kurds than they care about Europe. They care more about the Kurds than they care about what's going on in Syria. They've got 15 million of their own people that if they start to declare war or rebel with the backing of Russia to create its own state, that would really worry them. So it's interesting what Russia's doing here. It's hard to really make sense of it all. If you get out a map, I think that would be helpful for people to see how Russia is moving in through the Caucasus, down through the Kurdish region, and then if they have a supporter in the Assad regime, they've almost made it to the Mediterranean Sea. And again, I mean, that might be what they're trying to do. Turkey controls the Bosphorus. Turkey controls the Dardanelles that Russia needs to get its Black Sea fleet out from the Crimea. So maybe they're trying to go around that to increase their pressure, or at least get another outlet to the Mediterranean. So I would just grab a map and help people understand how big Russia's arm is stretching right into, you know, the main body of the world, the navel of the world, as it's been called.
Thanks for that, gentlemen. Definitely a situation we've got to keep our eye on. We're going to conclude this first segment with another story related to Syria. This is an interesting solution to the refugee crisis that's being proposed. And for this, we will go to Brent.
Yeah, there was a new trade deal that was announced between Jordan and Europe recently, and it's been reported on the Trumpet Weekly and today in AP. And it's interesting because it provides somewhat of a solution, albeit in a small way, to the refugee crisis. Jordan borders southern Syria. It's received around 600,000 refugees in the past 6 years, Syrians. And what this deal brokered by Europe and Jordan will accomplish is essentially getting Jordanians to employ those Syrian refugees. And if that would happen, then the EU would ease restrictions on trade into Europe from Jordan, essentially giving it somewhat of a free trade agreement between Jordan and the EU. And, you know, Jordan's already had a lot of problems with their unemployment levels. Tourism's been down in Jordan, which is a big weight on their economy. So Jordan sees this as a way of making their products more easily bought inside Europe, and a way that Europe ensures that it doesn't get more refugees that'll end up on its shores. It's only planning to, under the new pact, it's only 200,000 refugees that would be employed by the Jordanians, so it'd still leave a fair large number unemployed or pretty much stranded inside Jordan's territory. But we might get some insight of some of the creative solutions that Europe is looking at to try and stop the flow of migrants.
Any significance to collusion between Europe and Jordan?
For sure. I mean, if this is successful, I can see them trying to work this same policy with other nations, other Arab states that have already taken a lot of refugees, Lebanon, maybe even Turkey. I'm not sure what they're discussing at the meeting on Monday with European heads and Erdogan exactly. But you can see that they would be willing to throw a little bit of money. But even in this, I mean, they're getting it's pretty much a free trade deal, so they're not going to have to lose too many funds. But at least this way, it can slow the influx of refugees there. And looking at it prophetically, of course, as well, we have that relationship between Europe and these Sunni Arab states that is going to thrive inside, you know, during this time. So to see Europe being opening up its trade borders to Jordan, one of those Sunni states that we know it's going to be allied with in the future, and that could strengthen that relationship.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about toxic corporate debt and China's latest activities in the South China Sea. We'll also talk about Iran's elections and how Catholic bishops are trying to influence British voters. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Each week, the Trumpet staff compiles a digest of the most important news from the week. It's a 12-page report called the Trumpet Weekly. You can receive this free in your email inbox every Friday. If you visit thetrumpet.com, you can subscribe to that. And in this week's edition, we have a few stories about just how bad the health of the American economy really is. One of these stories is about toxic corporate debt. Distressed debt. And to tell us about this, we're going to turn to Robert Morley.
Yeah, distressed debt. I think this is going to be one of the big issues in 2016. It really looks like it's coming to the foreground right now. This toxic distressed debt is skyrocketing. In the month of February alone, it rose by 15%. That's up 265% from 1 year ago today. So we're talking about a very high rate of growth. There's over $327 billion worth of this distressed debt in the system.
Just define this for us.
Distressed debt is debt that analysts are looking at, that investors are looking at and saying it's not going to get paid. This is money that companies have borrowed, and now they're in trouble. And it's sitting out there, and the companies are either on the edge of not being able to pay it, or they're projecting ahead and saying there's no way they're going to make enough money to pay these bills.
So investors and lenders are going to end up holding the bag.
That's right. Somebody's going to hold the bag. It could be your pension fund that has invested money in these companies. Because remember, a lot of these companies are some of the biggest ones in America. These aren't just little mom and pop operations down the street. These are some very big companies in the United States. So this could be something that's going to have a lot of knockdown effects that people are not expecting whatsoever.
So a massive increase in this kind of debt over just the last year.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's what I find interesting about this. A lot of people have seen it coming in the oil and gas industry. Everybody knows the oil and gas industry, oil and gas prices are at record lows. So it just makes sense. A lot of these companies that levered themselves up, borrowed all this money to go out there and frack all these fields and get the oil and gas, they can't pay their bills. Everybody's seen this coming. A lot of experts have said, okay, this is trouble, but it's contained. It's contained within the oil and gas industry. Well, then commodity prices in general started collapsing. Oil prices, it spread to iron ore, to copper, to coal. Now we're looking at the whole commodity spectrum, and we're seeing mining companies across the line. They're in the same boat. And analysts looked at this and said, well, there is a lot. The numbers are getting bigger here. But it's just contained to the extractive industries, oil and gas, minerals and mining, those sorts of things.
They always have a good way of putting a positive spin on it, don't
they? That's right. But here's the thing. It's not contained. And most recent reports have been showing that it's spread far beyond now oil and gas and minerals and mining. We're seeing it hit telecommunications. We're seeing it hit technology companies and even utilities now, which are
traditionally considered, you know, the safe. Let's give these to the widows and orphans to invest in, because these are the biggest, safest, you know, slowest moving kind of companies out there. But even utilities have gotten themselves into trouble by borrowing too much money. And it is spreading, and people are wondering now, what does this all mean? And if you take a look at these levels of debt, it's what we're seeing is exactly what happened in 2007, in 2008, right into the lead up of Lehman Brothers collapsing. Remember, we saw this spike of unpayable debt around that time, and that's what took out Lehman Brothers. They had borrowed all this money, they had leveraged up their balance sheet, and suddenly they couldn't pay it back, and they found out there's nobody else willing to lend them more money. And that's what's happening across all these industries. And it's gone so far beyond oil and gas and minerals and mining that now the majority of the companies that are having trouble are outside of those sectors. So this is something that I think that a lot of people are going to wake up and find out that we're back where we were in 2008 very quickly.
The real problem here is exactly what you just said, that these companies that are so overleveraged, that are so deeply indebted, they come to a point where they just can't borrow any more money because nobody will lend it to them. And so then they're really in a pinch.
You nailed it. And here's the thing. The Federal Reserve is still talking about raising interest rates. You know, most of these analysts, it's like their head is in the sand. They aren't seeing this coming. It reminds me a lot about subprime. Remember back in 2007, 2008, it was contained. That was a word we heard all the time. Ben Bernanke or Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. It's contained. It's contained. And then it wasn't contained. And very quickly, it spread far beyond just Lehman Brothers.
So just very quickly, the effects once this begins to cascade.
Well, that's the big question. Where does it end? The society, U.S. corporate America, is so leveraged to debt, so dependent on debt. Anytime the wheels of the debt machine or the gears of the debt machine start jamming up, the consequences go, it's almost unlimited where they can end up. Remember back to 2007, 2008, we had companies like McDonald's, okay, one of the Coca-Cola companies that have tiny amounts of debt. But even they couldn't refinance their debt, which was potentially putting them into trouble. And the Fed had to step in and give loans to companies like McDonald's, if you can believe it. So unless authorities get on top of this, and even if they do, debt levels are so much bigger now in America, 8 years following the Great Recession, that the consequences could be a lot bigger.
Well, thanks, Robert. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour Week in Review. One story that we've been following for quite a while is how China continues to get a hold on the South China Sea. This week, we saw a story that shows another step in that process. For this story, we'll turn to Jeremiah.
Yeah, I know that we have a lot of listeners in the Philippines, and we're very grateful for their loyal support to the Trumpet Hour. And this next story takes place in the waters just off the coast of the Philippine Islands. As you said, it happened... China was the main actor here. It happened on Wednesday of this week, and China took over another atoll there in the South China Sea. An atoll is a coral reef that encloses a shallow lagoon or a group of lagoons, and they often comprise very rich fishing waters. And that is the case with this particular atoll. It's officially, it's called the Carino Atoll, but many Filipinos call it by its nickname, the Jackson Five, because there are actually five lagoons in the area. So it's kind of a hat tip to the American musical group that rose to fame there in the 1970s. And now the Filipinos are saying, I want you back to this Jackson Five, because the Chinese have taken over. As of Wednesday, China now has at least four Coast Guard ships stationed there, and they're denying access to all Filipino fishermen, and they've even chased some Filipino fishing boats away. So this is a piece of maritime property that has been a traditional fishing ground for Filipino fishermen for generations. And it was used mostly by the Filipinos from Palawan. But now it looks like those days are over. And it's significant that this is not an isolated incident. Just last month, Chinese surveillance vessels harassed a Philippine Navy logistics ship that was near the Hasa-Hasa Shoal, another Filipino fishing ground, and that one's just 60 nautical miles from the southern tip of Palawan. And then back in 2012, the Chinese took control of Scarborough Shoal after a brief standoff with the Philippine Navy there. The Philippine Navy had tried to arrest some Chinese poachers. They were illegally fishing some some baby sharks and some other illegal fish from the waters there. But the Chinese were able to resist arrest and chase the Filipinos off there. And the Chinese have never left Scarborough Shoal since then. So they've been there for about 4 years denying access. So it's a really worrying trend, and it shows that China has no regard for international law and that the Chinese are taking more and more aggressive behavior just to make good on their claims to ridiculous amounts of ocean and turf there in the South China Sea.
China continues its march. Thank you, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We talked last week in anticipation of Iranian parliamentary elections. They took place last Friday. Some people were hoping for a new dawn for reformism in Iran after that nuclear deal that took place. But Brent Noctegal is here to give us an update of what happened in these elections. Brent.
Yeah, so if you listen to the news and watch the news, as you do probably if you're listening to this program, you would have seen that it was a stunning victory for moderates inside the parliamentary elections in Iran, and then also the Assembly of Experts, that powerful clerical group that decides upon this next supreme leader. But there have been a number of other articles out there that kind of show why this is a little bit of a mirage and a delusion that we have moderate victories in Iran. And we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly. It's called No New Dawn in Iran by Ruthie Bloom. And it was published in a number of different papers. And it's just interesting because the group that came that looked like they did much better than expected was basically the President Rouhani's parliamentary group and their coalition. They were known as the moderate camp. But it's good just to remember how really moderate these people are. We call them moderates in the press, and the press loves to trumpet that, but they're not moderate in their views at all. We'll remember Rouhani himself before he was made president of Iran. He was actually one of the lead negotiators in nuclear discussions. And this is what he said back in 2005. So this is one of the moderates that got more power, if you like, just a typical example. In 2005, he said that while we were talking to the Europeans in Tehran, we were installing equipment in parts of the Afsajan facility. By creating a calm environment, we were able to complete our work. So this is a moderate that says we were conning the world, talking to the Europeans about, hey, we want to stop our nuclear program. And at the same time, he's boasting that they continued their nuclear program. These are the type of moderates that are going into the parliamentary group and the council or assembly of experts. Just the conclusion here of Ruthie Bloom's article. She says, let's not kid ourselves. Rouhani's showing in the elections does not signify a new era of freedom for the Iranian people, nor does it indicate a shift away from the regime's sponsorship of global terrorism. On the contrary, if anything, it could provide American voters with a false sense of national and international security that is utterly unwarranted. We shouldn't feel good about these elections. The same people are back in power. As we said last week, these are the same vetted. These people were all vetted by the regime so that they could run. They were happy with any of these candidates getting in power. And just because the West paints them as moderates, don't believe that they're anything such.
Right. The press wants so much to believe that this is good news from Iran, but you got to look at the big picture here. Well, thanks for that story, Brent. And to conclude this segment, we'll look at a story from Britain related to the upcoming referendum on whether or not it will remain in the European Union. For this story, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, well, a very interesting development in Britain's conundrum whether to stay in the European Union or not has been the Catholic Church's stance on the issue. The Catholic Church has always been very pro-European Union. I think even the two of the founding fathers of the European Union are being considered for sainthood in the Vatican now. And their stance is they'd kind of like Britain to stay. They had the retired Bishop of Westminster, Cardinal Murphy O'Connor, is close to Pope Francis and has recently said, though Christian churches will not take position on the referendum vote, Catholics should vote for Europe, which, I don't know, to me at least, that kind of sounds like he did take a position on whether Britain should stay in Europe or not. But the interesting, I guess, is this article we have in our Trumpet Weekly will point out is the English Catholics probably aren't going to be very inclined to care what the Catholic Church has to say about their referendum. But the Scottish Catholics are going to take such talk much more seriously, just really highlighting the fact that there are really two unions at stake here. And if Britain decides to go against the Catholic Church and leave Britain, Scotland may be up again to see if the two leave the United Kingdom and stay with Britain. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Right, yeah, we're going to definitely be keeping our eyes on that referendum this upcoming June. We'll have a lot more to talk about that in the coming weeks and months. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we're talking about on the program today are in this week's edition. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That is coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Robert.
Well, the Great Wall of Trump appears to have sparked a migrant rush at the border. The United States Customs and Border Protection data show that over 150,000 migrants were detained trying to cross the border between October and February, and that number is up 24% from the same period last year. And Reuters interviewed some of these migrants, and the common response that they appeared to be getting is that they've heard that Donald Trump wants to shut down the border, so they want to get across before that happens.
Well, they've got all kinds of reasons. Before, it was because of President Obama's easy policies, and now they're stepping their foot on the accelerator because of Trump's potential policies. We'll go now to Andrew.
Yes, Egypt's parliament expelled a well-known lawmaker this week for meeting with the Israeli ambassador for dinner. The lawmaker claimed he wanted to meet with the Israeli ambassador about the Grand Renaissance Dam. This dam is an Ethiopian project to generate electricity from the Nile that a lot of Egyptians fear is going to start cutting into Egypt's share of the Nile's water supply. So after the lawmaker met with the Israeli ambassador to talk about Egypt's stance on this, the parliament kicked him out. Apparently, even though Israel and Egypt have had a peace treaty signed for 37 years, any public interaction with Israeli officials is still considered a political taboo in Egypt.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
The six-member Gulf Cooperation Council decided on Wednesday to formally define Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shiite terrorist group, as such, as a terrorist organization. Now, this is a pretty big deal. The GCC are fighting against Hezbollah's interest inside Lebanon. And then lately, inside Yemen as well, Hezbollah has been spotted inside Yemen, really undermining the GCC's effort to get rid of the Houthis. Hezbollah has actually been supporting the Houthis and reducing the gains that Saudi Arabia and the other states have made. So this is really increasing the pressure on Hezbollah inside Lebanon to try and weaken that group's power hold over the government. They blacklisted some of the companies inside Saudi Arabia also that had done business with Hezbollah. So it's really sidelining this Shiite terrorist group in hopes that in Lebanon they'll weaken their grip on power.
And now over to Jeremiah.
Well, public support for Russian President Vladimir Putin to serve another term hit the highest level in 4 years. A survey showed on Thursday that 74% of Russians would vote to re-elect Putin as president, and analysts say the reason Russians love Putin so much is because they love what he's doing in Syria and Ukraine and in other geopolitical hotspots. With all these moves, Putin is proclaiming the message that Russia is again a force to be reckoned with on the world stage, and the voters want him to keep on proclaiming that message.
He's a winner. Let's go back over to Robert.
Well, New Zealand began voting on a flag change this week, and over the next 3 weeks, people will be able to go and post their ballots. And it looks like right now that New Zealanders probably will opt to keep the Union Jack in the corner of their flag. The alternative they're being given is a silver fern, so we'll just have to wait and see what happens there.
All right, let's go back over to Brent.
The other story I want people to just be aware of is that on Monday there is a huge meeting between European heads of state, David Cameron, Angela Merkel, François Hollande, and Turkish Premier Erdogan, and they'll be meeting on the refugee crisis and trying to see how to solve it. Now, this is extremely important because German politicians inside even the coalition of Ms. Merkel have been waiting for this discussion to see what Merkel can get out of Turkey. Turkey holds the keys to the gates to Europe of the refugees. If for the refugees, if the refugee crisis is going to be solved, Turkey has to stop allowing these people to pass through. And some people have said, including Horst Seehofer, the governor of Bavaria, that you know he will decide whether he's going to support Merkel or not based on what she can get out of this meeting on Monday. So stay clued in and see what the big big decisions are to come out of this meeting.
And over to Andrew.
Approximately 3,000 supporters of an anti-Islamic movement attended the demonstration this week in the German city of Dresden. Many protesters were chanting against German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and some were seen carrying signs calling for her to leave office. This anti-immigrant group has become a magnet for xenophobic sentiments since it was founded in the East German city 2 years ago. The group has held many protests over the arrival of thousands of migrants to Germany and is exacerbating the ongoing German migrant crisis.
All right, you have another one, Jeremiah.
Yes, the Chinese government is using pop music to instill patriotism and nationalism into young Chinese citizens. We published an article by the Global Times which shows how the government is harnessing pop, rock, and punk idols in order to attract young people. So popular musicians are now writing new revamped versions of China's old revolutionary red songs. And the themes of these songs range from publicizing government plans to praising the country's prosperity. I've heard some of the American pop and rock music that's popular among young people, and I think the themes are quite different than what you hear in those new Chinese songs. There's a quote here from Mr. Wu Dezu. He's the director of the very Orwellian-titled New Media Division of the Communist Party's Central Committee. He explained the strategy behind this, saying, if we use the youth idols in a proper way, we can help young people build a correct worldview. So it really sounds pretty Orwellian, and it is just a sign of increasing authoritarianism there in the Chinese government.
Do they like the Jackson 5 over there?
I couldn't say. I hope so.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we talk about on this program are in The Trumpet Weekly. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Brenton Octagall, Andrew Miller, and Robert Morley.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of Marcus Tullius Cicero. To be ignorant of what occurred before you were born is to remain always a child. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.